Under the weather. This is Frank from Swiss America. We're going to be going ahead and doing the program for him until he gets to feeling better. What I wanted to do was tonight, especially because of what's going on in Washington, is discuss money. And in line with that, I have with me Jeff. Jeff is a individual like what Bill and I talked about, one of those 46 million people that doesn't pay taxes. He's not in jail. He's a free inhabitant. And, Jeff, welcome aboard. How are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Well, money. What is money?
Money, it's a five-letter word that you can find in the dictionary, and most people think it's the little green pieces of paper with president's pictures on it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the law, money has many, many different definitions. For example, real money is metallic precious coins. The term money in itself includes both real money and certificates of deposit, but does not include notes.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows Federal Reserve notes, those green pieces of paper, are not money.
Exactly. At least the listeners of the Out of the Time know that. They're much ahead on the learning curve. But what I'd really like to get into is in detail when we're dealing with these notes and when we get away from lawful money, what happens to us?
Well, when you don't pay your debt, then you are only discharging them, if you discharge them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, if people hold a Social Security number or have applied for an account number, they became contributors to the federal bankruptcy. They underwrote the government. And as part of that procedure, they pledged their labor and their property to the government. Now, they're in a strange situation where they no longer have property rights because it's already been pledged to the creditor.
All right, let's back up a little bit. Let's go into the bankruptcy detail and what FDR did to us.
Well, FDR, when he first became president, declared a state of emergency, and it was codified by Congress in House Joint Resolution 192. If you can decipher the gibberish, it basically boils down to that the federal government announced to their creditor that they would not pay the debt. At that point, the creditor, being a very nice creditor, foreclosed and took over the federal government. Now, for all practical purposes, it's still the United States government, but the beneficial interest of the public trust was transferred from the people, that's you and I, to the creditor.
Which is?
The stockholders of the Federal Reserve Corporation.
That private corporation.
Correct. That was incorporated under the Federal Reserve Act of 1913.
Okay, and continue.
So with this bankruptcy situation, the creditor was very smart. He realized, or she, could not confiscate anything the federal government owned, for the federal government only were trustees for the public property. So the creditors would actually receive nothing. But when they made Congress the trustee in bankruptcy, Congress therefore became the trustee with a fiduciary obligation that is the highest duty recognized by law. So it superseded their oath to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And became trustees in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. So basically, the whole situation is more of a corporate standpoint than a government standpoint.
In a sense, yes. And with that, they created these various avenues where you and I and the people of the United States of America could be tricked into underwriting and pledging assets, our labor, our property, even our children, for the benefit of the creditor. And this can be dug up, and it takes time, but you have to go through the definition of the terms, go through the laws, and you'll find a pattern emerging. where the actual words of, for instance, the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, the term contribution has a specific legal meaning that one who is equally liable in paying a claim. So when you signed up with FICA, you became a contributor, equally liable as the federal government. And that's how we all became paupers in the eyes of the law.
Mm-hmm.
We had given away all our property to the creditor, and we also asked for charity from the public treasury.
And by doing both, what have we done to ourselves?
We have lost all property rights. And once you lose property rights, you lose protection of the law.
So when these people complain about, well, I've got constitutional rights, I've got constitutional rights.
That is correct. All rights and sovereignty devolve from property. For example, we've heard of people who travel without driver's licenses and proofs of registration. Now, if you phrase the argument in your mind, you're before a judge and a judge says, how do you plead to the charge of driving without a license? I could respond, Judge, I don't understand. I was traveling on my public roads in my private property. Why do I need permission from government to do that?
Well, the judge is going to say,
he won't have an answer. However, if you appear before that judge as a bankrupt, a pauper, a vagabond with no property rights, you're not on your public roads, and you're not in your private automobile. They belong to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that simple argument can be traced back to everything they do with income taxation, ad valorem taxation, regulation, the requirement for people to have licenses just to have a dog or a cat.
Mm-hmm. And primarily because we're dealing with fraudulent paper instruments.
That is part and parcel to it. As we lost property rights, we started using their waste paper Federal Reserve notes, which have no par value. And so we never ever paid our debts. We were only, in effect, getting custody of the property we bought. And that custody was a taxable privilege.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you done any research? Have you figured out how they played this angle to basically get property that they claim to belong to the federal government when it clearly states in the Constitution they're not allowed to own property other than, munitions and this and that? It's limited.
Well, it looks like some of the property that might be being transferred to the internationalists was private property to begin with. If you can check, most of the national parks were donations from rich landholders, like the Rockefellers.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they bought Cherokee National Forest and gave it to them. So in one sense, the folks who are the creditors or who are stockholders might be manipulating the scene so that we really can't figure out what's going on,
mm-hmm.
that they're only transferring their own property.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes down to it, Washington, D.C., federal courthouses and forts, those properties were, in effect, through the act of the local state legislatures, deeded to the United States government for specific purposes. And I don't think the federal government has the authority to sell that property to anyone but the state. So they would have, if they relinquish or give up a base, it must revert back to the state.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot remain in federal jurisdiction.
Well, that seems to be taking place. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any of that going on, but what there is a legitimate concern out there with a lot of people are, these parks all of a sudden having UN biosphere on them and in various other associations like that. And everybody, well, how can you do that? Because, it's public land. And that's somewhere along the line, and I'm sure this whole bankruptcy thing and everything ties it all together.
Well, one could bring out that argument. Now, if it's private property that was transferred to the federal government under one of these charitable arrangements,
mm-hmm.
we might find that there's a smoking gun. On the other hand, if it's something that the federal government supposedly bought with the concurrence of the state legislature, I would be very curious to see what the research shows on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because for one thing, the federal government didn't pay their debts after 1933. So any property bought by the federal government really did not transfer title.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't transfer title, then the original property owners have a valid claim.
Okay, so for those of you that are into this research, you need to look at that angle. Any title transfers after 1933 then would appear to be invalid.
That's right, like the Tennessee Valley Authority. All that land that was confiscated under the eminent domain, the people were never paid real money. Now, if the people themselves had no property rights by virtue of them having social security numbers, then it's a moot point. But if those people were truly holding property rights and were not compensated justly, then they have a valid claim to come back and say, okay, I want this dam and I want that power generation and I want this lake. This is mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully with your research and others assisting you that you've got helping you, you'll be able to get to some conclusions regarding that. But back to the money. Okay, a piece of green paper, it has a denomination on it. It says dollar. What exactly is a dollar?
Well, by law, the Coinage Act of 1792, it was a 1 ounce silver coin with approximately 3/4 of an ounce of pure silver in it. And the government still calls it that in the law. Let me see if I can find the exact site here. In 12 U.S.C. 411, Federal Reserve notes were defined as obligations of the United States government. However, the coins are still legislated in the government. I believe they use metric now, and they hold that the 1 ounce coin is 31 grams, and which is equivalent to the number of grains in the silver coin. So they're still making the law state that dollars are dollars.
Now, how does the Federal Reserve note come off saying dollar on it?
Well, it was originally a note, which is a promise to pay. And the government, in the original Federal Reserve Act, did promise to pay the bearer on demand $1, and you could get it at the U.S. Treasury or any Federal Reserve Bank. Now, that makes sense until 1933, at which point the government said that in House Joint Resolution 1-92, that they would no longer guarantee the exchange rate of the dollar. Now, they weren't referring to the exchange rate of the dollar for foreign currency. They were talking about the exchange of a dollar for a Federal Reserve note. And they said after this point in time, no contracts denominated in gold would be honored by the United States government with dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty clear that the federal government went bankrupt and the creditors came in and took over.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be also found in the Reorganization Act that appeared after 1933.
The Reorganization Act, explain that for people.
Well, when anyone goes bankrupt, one of the first things the trustee does is reorganize the business to help pay off the creditors.
In essence, Chapter 11.
That's correct. And coincidentally enough, the Reorganization Acts don't appear before 1933 in the United States Code. And I've done a search in the 50 titles, and it only the earliest one I could find is 1939. So the federal government was reorganized periodically after the bankruptcy for the benefit of the creditor.
Mm-hmm. Just as any individual would.
That is correct. And there is in the congressional record, Congressman James Traficant from Ohio just mentioned that, yes, we're in Chapter 11 and we're in the biggest reorganization of the bankrupt entity.
Yeah, that was in 1993, if I'm correct.
So they know about it. The person does not know about it because, again, we're not led to read the law, nor...
Now, we're wasted our time with O.J. and Ice Balls at Giants games.
Oh, my goodness. That's more important.
Yes, not your livelihood and everything that you work for, and the fact that you've basically, by dealing with a social security system and fraudulent notes, you've waived your rights in protections under the Constitution.
That is correct. You've given up everything you ever will own or earn in exchange for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people think that they've paid for something. When they've taken Federal Reserve notes, and they've taken their car, and they've paid off their obligation to the bank, but that's not necessarily so, is it?
That's what the law says. Article 1, Section 10 says states are forbidden to accept anything but gold and silver coin in payment of debt. So actually, no one has paid their debt since 1933.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, anyone who has used Federal Reserve notes has not paid their debts. There are those who do know the facts and have used lawful money and have established a bill of sale that will protect their property rights.
Mm-hmm. In essence, in property, it's a lodial titleship, is it not?
That is correct.
And then you can do the same with vehicles and with other items.
That is very correct. The three things that determine a lodial title or proof of ownership are A, you have the right to own, B, you use lawful consideration, and C, no one has a superior claim. And those can be easily established.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, that you have the right to own, you basically revoke your signature on the application for Social Security and renounce all the benefits. of that pauperization.
Oh, my goodness, Jeff. I mean, Social Security, I've worked all my life for Social Security. How could I possibly do that? This is not an easy step. I mean, this is something that people really need to consider.
Right. And you can go look up in any Black's Law Dictionary and look up the term pension, and it plainly states a pension plan is that which the government gives in exchange for valuable services rendered to the government. Now, you think about it. If you're getting a Social Security pension, what service did you give to the government if you were in the private sector? The whole fact is, once you apply to Social Security, no matter whom you worked for, you are presumed to be a government employee.
A federal employee, a United States citizen.
Well, not only that, but as an employee, you were obligated to pay the bankruptcy. That's how it was like a dual-edged sword. You thought you were getting a benefit, that insurance, when in fact you insured the federal government and became a de facto employee subject to Internal Revenue.
So the bottom line is, if people were smart and they would look at this intelligently, they would get away from the Social Security system. They would do what they needed to do to get away from dealing with the unlawful money and, the, in essence, the slavery it places them under, and use those resources and invest for their own future.
Correct. Gold and silver coin, denominated in dollars, is the only lawful money in the United States of America.
Okay. And Federal Reserve notes get you nothing but trouble, then.
That is correct. You are trading with the enemy.
Go into that a little bit. A lot of people aren't familiar with that concept.
Well, in the original Trading with the Enemy Act, and I believe in 1917, when we entered World War I, the president was authorized to give licenses to those who had contracts with the enemy. Say, for instance, you were a wool dealer who had contracts with the German government. The federal government was not authorized to go in and totally bust up your contract. Article 1, Section 10 says states are forbidden to impair the obligations of contracts. So what the president did was regulate and manage your contact with the enemy through licensing. In other words, you were given permission to trade with the enemy. Well, in 1933, the law was slightly changed to remove the exemption for U.S. citizens. And one way of looking at it, since the Federal Reserve is a foreign corporation with respect to the state, because it's federal, and the federal government itself is a foreign corporation with respect to the state, when you deal with the Federal Reserve, you are dealing with an enemy of the United States, or it foreclosed. So anytime you get the benefit of interest, or you're dealing with the credit debt money, you are trading with the enemy.
Subject, therefore,
to the president's authority to regulate you through his delegate, the Secretary of Treasury. Now, the Secretary of Treasury happens to have a bunch of subtitles and responsibilities that are carefully obfuscated in the code. Technically, the Secretary of Treasury does not work for the United States government. When he is in the capacity of governor of the fund, governor of the World Bank, the Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and several other international banks. So what it boils down to is the Secretary of Treasury is picked by the president, but the United States government doesn't pay him. He is paid by the fund. Well, who is the fund? Well, their fiduciary agent is the Federal Reserve Corporation. And again, this chain of evidence links back to the creditor. So here we are, 60-plus years of living in bankruptcy under the control of the Secretary of Treasury, the governor of the fund, the governor of the bank, and all these other scoundrels.
All because we allowed our right to deal in lawful money to be taken away from us.
In our own ignorance, we stopped using money, and we didn't watch our servants.
And now we've become their servants.
Exactly.
Now, there's a lot more to money than just that, and a lot more to the banking system. Signature cards are a perfect example. Go into the signature card a little bit.
Well, since all Federal Reserve banks and banks that are signatory to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, by virtue of that contract, they are instrumentalities of the United States government. Now, that's not to say they are the government. They are instrumentalities. For instance, a corporation has to ask permission from the state or the federal or whatever its sovereign authority is to grant it existence. So when you deal with a Federal Reserve Bank and you sign a signature card, you obligated yourself to obey the rules of the bank. The big bank. The bank that the Secretary of Treasury dictates orders. Now, if you happen to be a foreigner with no social security number, you can open an account in the United States of America with a Federal Reserve Bank and not have any income tax liability. But if you are a U.S. citizen or resident with a social security number, you are obligated to obey the rules of the Secretary of Treasury. And that ties you into Title 26. All the people I know that successfully fought the IRS and were not thrown in jail had two important factors. A, they had revoked their signature on Social Security, and B, they had no open bank accounts. And if any of those two criteria were not met, the IRS came in and danced on their face, literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot of things that people don't think about. I've heard the gamut. You know, they deal with Federal Reserve notes, and they, you know, put threat, duress, coercion on their checks, and they do all these things, but they're missing the point, and it's just, it's a matter of time before they get snatched up and made an example of, as the Marsh trial points out.
That's right. One of Phil Marsh's biggest mistakes was he never advised his people to get rid of the Social Security number. He felt that that was immaterial because it doesn't seem to have any code behind it. But the key is you have to understand the nature of the terminology, which they never had to put into law because it was part of the common law. For example, if you go back to the Articles of Confederation, in Article 4, the government is given three special dispensations, or, easy outs. In other words, they're excused from protecting your rights. And those three categories are pauper, vagabond, or fugitive from justice. Any one of those three characters are absolved. They do not have rights, privileges, and immunities as guaranteed by the Constitution. And I found corroboration for that when I went to old law books that were printed before the 1890s. There were many sites where the government was authorized to violate your rights. And the key item or idea was all these victims were paupers, vagabonds, inebriates, imbeciles, someone who had, in effect, been given over to the government for their control. And I started digging around, and I found it, the authorization through that. So when you signed up for Social Security and lost all property rights, that was just one half of it. The other side of the coin was, can you get food stamps? Can you get welfare? Can you get unemployment compensation without a Social Security number?
Of course not.
There you go. If you're getting charity from the public treasury, you're deemed a pauper. And that's one of the exclusions under the articles. So everyone holding a Social Security number, no matter whether they apply for it or not, since they have the ability or the capability to get charity, they are getting a charity, therefore they're pauperized.
Okay. Now, you are out of the system. You deal only with lawful money. But the realities are that a lot of people are still tied up into it, and for whatever reason, they've got this or that locking them in until they can get out. For those people, is there an option for them, like via a trust, that they can use to separate themselves from the monetary system that's been established and deal with constitutional money?
That has been offered in many places as a solution. I've heard people talk about common law trust, but you better be careful. The fiduciary obligation of a trustee is the highest duty recognized by law. If someone came to me and asked me to be a trustee, I would certainly require payment that is equivalent to the great responsibility I'm accepting. There are people out there selling trusts for peanuts, for practically nothing. So it makes me feel that these people are not true trustees, but are just running a scam to get as much money as they can and have no intention of being a true trustee.
Or either that, or they haven't looked into it enough and are getting themselves out on a very steep and high ledge.
You get that right. See, a trust takes on the characteristics of the trustee, and if any of these so-called common law trustees are any way impaired, as a pauper, a vagabond, or fugitive from justice, holding a Social Security account or a bank signature card, they are not common law trusts. It's the equivalent of if I gave the car keys to my 8-year-old son and said, son, I'm trusting you with the keys to my car while I'm gone next week, and I want you to clean the car and wash it. When I come back, and I find my son has sold the car, and he's going to come to me and say, Dad, look at this. I've got a bag of jelly beans. I sold it to the next-door neighbor. Ain't I a good son? And I'd smack him upside the head and say, son, you had no right to sell my car. You had no property rights. You are only a trustee with custody of my property. That's the same situation the average American is. He cannot take property that's technically in the public trust, pledged to the creditor, and transfer it to a private trust. That would be a breach of trust, and he would be committing a crime.
So if people are getting involved with trust, they best be very careful about what they're doing.
That is correct.
And it is not a panacea.
That is correct. Make sure the trustee is in sovereign capacity with no impairment, and have the trust buy the property with a minimum of 21 in silver dollars.
Mm-hmm. And why 21 in silver?
Seventh Amendment to the Constitution protects our rights. We have the right to a trial by jury under the common law rule if the value in question exceeds $20.
So basically, in order to put it in a court situation where they don't want it to be, you've got to do it with at least 21.
Exactly. That's the magic silver bullet that establishes property rights. And no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Now, even though the Judiciary Act of 1789 abolished common law courts, the rules still apply if you had property rights.
Now, in regards to the $21 and the discharge of debt, one thing that you pointed out a while ago was vehicles, license plates. There's a little tab on there. It says something very interesting in the background. It says, state official use only. Now, to me, when a vehicle says official use only, it means I don't own it. The state owns it. Now, if you look and go into that a little bit.
Yeah, the state is the trustee and the beneficiary is the creditor. So the creditor has the rights to the property, and all you have is the use that you pay your fee, which is taxes,
registration.
Exactly.
So how do you get your vehicle then? If you've discharged the debt to the bank, how do you go about getting it for yourself?
Well, again, the three facts that establish ownership is that, A, you have the right to own. That's first and foremost. Once you have the right to own, then you can buy your automobile for 21 in silver. Now, if it's already been paid for and all claims have been dropped, you could sell it to a good friend for 21 and buy it back for 22. Silver dollars. Now you have a bill of sale that it was bought for lawful money, and no one has a superior claim. And to establish that, I would suggest that you put a legal notice in the newspaper describing the vehicle, color, and the VIN number, and ask anyone with a claim upon that vehicle to come forward within 30 days or forever waive their claims. Now, if the state used that colorable title to pledge your automobile for debt, and once you gave that legal notice and the creditor doesn't come forward, well, that's it. No further claims.
Okay, but bottom line is no one can do anything with that until they start from square one and take themselves away from being a pauper or a vagabond.
Correct.
They've got to establish their status first before they can go any further.
Right. When it comes down to property rights, you first got to establish no one owns you. If you're a slave to the creditor, anything you have custody of already belongs to the creditor, which is why the IRS can confiscate without due process of law. They're not taking your property, they're taking the creditor's property.
And who they work for. They're nothing but a collection agent for the creditor.
Correct. Now, for the people that are caught between the rock and the hard place where they can't really get all the way out of the system, they might consider using trust as the instrument to protect property, but again, it won't be able to protect their own property rights, for they have none. All they're doing is playing a game, pitting one trap door of the creditor against another special interest, because the people who set up this scam put in place all the protections of the trusts and foundations back in the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
They foresaw what was coming, because they were controlling it, they were planning this.
Sure. And where do they put their resources in trusts? I mean, you look at public access, all you see is the Rockefeller Trust paid for this, or this Ohio Trust, or all these various trusts and foundations make these donations.
Right.
And that's how these people avoid paying their taxes.
That's correct. And in some respects, birth certificate has been one of the most nefarious.
I thought, Jeff, we're going to be going to a commercial. Even as ill as he is, he's putting in his time behind the... Okay. people while he's doing that. All realize at Swiss America that sovereign yet, although that would for us. Give Swiss America get off go into it a little later, but we've got some situations up in Washington with the new money and stuff of problem. All Swiss America. Contracts. This is all this stuff is done through contracts, through trusts, and all these other things. These new $100 bills, tell me about them.
Are we in the air right now?
Yeah, we're on the air.
Well, apparently, they're trying to make them counterfeit-proof, or at least that's what they're telling the people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some anomalies about them. One is that they've got to get the original listing on all Federal Reserve notes had the issuing bank seal. Now they're removing the unique seal and putting in the generic Federal Reserve System seal. They're also getting us ready to accept the idea of a local or internal to the United States currency and an external currency. Part of the problem, again, is we have, for over 60 years, have been in a bankruptcy and have not been dealing with property rights. And with that twisted arrangement, we became common carriers needing insurance as if we were some kind of commercial entity instead of real human beings. And now we're facing the situation where we have to pay the piper. We've had the benefit of being bankrupt for all these years.
But it's to the point now where their reorganizations aren't cutting it and something's fixing to break. Now, a little bit of background. I just went to the bank, and I don't have an account, so I cash things out, and I turn it into the notes, and then I turn the portion of that into silver and gold. But I'm always asking, when are you getting the new money? When are you getting the new money? Last time I was there, we'll be getting that early in January. I'd like to get one of those. And she just, the teller grabbed the manager as the manager came walking by. When are we getting the new money? Why? Well, he wants some. She asked me, the manager asked me, says, why are you traveling overseas? That tells me, two-tiered money system, Senate Bill 307. If it doesn't pass as Senate Bill 307, I would expect to see it as an executive order. Then, she said, it will be a special order item only. It's not going to be out there for general circulation. You're going to have to say, I want some of those and place an order to get that. I have a problem with that. That's very troubling. That tells me some things, it's just strictly speculation, but we've been, aware of the possibilities of the differences in contracts of a devaluation. Now, how would all that work, potentially?
It appears what the government wants to do is set up a situation. First, they drive American industries down and convince people they have to work for less. Then they turn around and make the money worth less and create a genuine slave economy. Because right now, if the only jobs available are service, translate that into servant industries. There will be no manufacturing industries of any importance in the United States of America.
And that's pretty much been occurring with GATT and NAFTA.
That's the situation exactly. Once you destroy the ability to produce surplus, whether it's goods or services, you destroy the basis of wealth. So, over the three decades, or the three generations they've had since 1933, they've been training each following generation to be a little bit more stupider than the one before it. So right now, people actually think they're getting something for nothing. when, in fact, they've given everything they own for nothing of value.
And it's amazing to me how people latch on to those Federal Reserve notes and think how wonderful they are, and they don't understand what they've done to themselves by dealing with those.
That's right. The richest man in America, if all his wealth is denominated in Federal Reserve notes, owns nothing. If he has a Social Security number, he is only custodian. He's no better off than a sharecropper.
Now, if there was a reading material that you would recommend for everything, I notice in the books that you put out, you make a lot of references to Black's Law. I would imagine that would be one that people should have on their desk.
That is correct. A good law dictionary is a very helpful tool because you have to understand the language. And the earlier dictionaries, if you go to garage sales or pick up any the old law dictionaries, they're priceless. If you can get old Bouvier's, Black's Law before 1913, you'll have a better description and a definition. You will also find Noah Webster's dictionary of the early 1800s very useful because the terminology did not diverge at that point. The legal phraseology was part of the American language.
Unlike now, where everything is watered down and assumptions are made and everything has been swapped around.
Exactly. So if someone asked me, what do you need to read? I suggest you start with the United States Constitution and read it through, and then when you're done reading it through, read it through again, and read it through a few more times. And after you read it through a couple hundred times, you might get an understanding that something is amiss, because the contract with America was made in 1789, but it was never signed.
And that contract was?
The United States Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It is an unsigned contract. It was only witnessed. The true signed contract, which is still in force, is the Articles of Confederation, 1777. And you'll find in there many, many protections for the people. In fact, the word free and citizen and free and people are not used in the Constitution, but are used in the Articles. They talk about free inhabitants, free citizens, free people. So the bottom line is the U.S. Constitution is internal to government, and I would never demand constitutional rights. I demand my unalienable right that their Constitution promised not to inflict or impair in any way, shape, or form. And again, that goes back to property rights. You have to have the right to own property before you have property rights.
And you can't own property as long as you're dealing with debt instruments and you're dealing with the Social Security system. People are all concerned right now about, well, I'll see a UFO before I see Social Security. What would be far better off for America at large is for Social Security to go bankrupt and to go away.
Well, again, since it's already bankrupt, what is the real situation is any of the monies or currencies paid in on behalf of Social Security were spent by Congress as current revenue, and Congress issued another IOU into the Social Security Trust Fund.
So we've got IOUs on top of IOUs on top of IOUs.
The so-called $746 billion surplus in Social Security is $746 billion of IOUs that will be redeemed by higher taxes in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's insanity, to charge a person a tax so they can pay higher taxes in the future.
And we have a situation developing for the 28th of this month. We are still not going anywhere from a legal standpoint in Washington. This is going to be a train wreck.
Right. They have to create a crisis before they can notch up that debt ceiling and do the next step. Because right now, if you check the current individual income tax revenues, they are less than the debt service. The interest on the national debt is now greater than all the individual income tax receipts. So you can truthfully say, if you're a current U.S. taxpayer, none of your money goes to the government. It goes all to the creditor.
But people still want to deal with those Federal Reserve notes. They have a hard time accepting, oh, wait a minute, after 60-some years, oh, my God, no, these have value. These have value. Why would I want to buy gold? Gold, that's $400 for one of those. It's 400 Federal Reserve notes is the important thing. The gold has maintained its value.
Right.
Now, the thing that people don't understand, why should I buy gold? I hear that they're going to be getting rid of gold, but that's not true. They can't.
It's in the law. Title 12, United States Code, Section 5112, says the denominations and specifications of coins. The inscription of the $1 is on a 1 ounce fine silver coin weighing 31.103 grams. That's lawful money of the United States. The stuff that is not silver is not lawful money. It's counterfeit.
The sandwich coins, the current crop coins. There's a lot of people out there that think, well, just as long as I'm not doing Federal Reserve notes and I do these coins, I'm okay. But that's not true either, is it?
Not at all.
No, it's not just waste and weights right. and measures.
And interestingly enough, I came across a law. It's no longer codified, but if you had fractions of a dollar, like half silver dollars or quarter silver dollars, they were not considered to be a lawful consideration in amounts greater than $12. And I looked at that and I said, what in the world are they saying? Then the light bulb came on. Seventh Amendment says half to exceed $20. So if you have fractional coins, they will not establish ownership. So folks who thought junk silver was going to save their butt won't work because the law says it has to be dollars. That's the full 1 ounce coin.
Not fractionals.
That's right.
And not an accumulation of a fractional. That's all part and parcel of understanding and doing the research that you've done. A little background on Jeff, computer engineer, IBM, former IBM, former Lockheed Aerospace. The man knows how to do his research. He writes some wonderful books. They're very easy to read. They're very easy to understand. He documents extensively title and code. I would encourage you people to call Jeff and get his books. How can people get in touch with you to get into that, Jeff?
Well, they can call me at 770-579-8331. I've got a 24-hour voicemail, fax, and data line. So you can get faxes on demand or just go through the voicemail menu. Now, also, if you want to write to me, write to Living Word, care of Post Office Box, 671567, Marietta, Georgia, postal code 30067.
Okay, repeat the number, repeat the address.
Okay, the phone number is area code 770-579-8331. Mailing location, Living Word. Care of Post Office Box 671567, Marietta, Georgia 30067. I have 5 books currently in print, starting with In God We Trust and Tax We Bust, through the Patriot Primer Series 1 and 2, Playing in Traffic, and Winning the Child Support Battle.
You've learned this stuff the hard way.
Oh, you bet.
Oh, and just for you people that are wondering, Living Word, yes, it is a church. Yes, Jeff is a pastor as well.
That is correct. I dedicated myself and my life to a ministry of helping others get out of slavery. Once I had the truth, I said, God, get me out of this. And I believe God did a wonderful job. All praise to Him.
And now you help others get out as well.
That is correct.
All right, money. Where do we go from here? What are our possibilities? The ballot box doesn't work anymore.
That is correct.
We've got one resort before the cartridge box, and that's the money box. What can we do about that?
Well, I believe there's a 51% solution. Let me explain that. Once 51% of the people join Social Security, the federal government could look at that private trust as a public trust and take it over. Once 51% of the population leaves Social Security, then it devolves from a public to a private trust, then Congress has no further duty to manage it. At that point, the creditor cannot access you, your property, or your money. You're free. And Congress is also free of the obligation to manage the poor paupers out there, because they left. So in that sense, that's how we can hit them in the pocketbook, because once you don't have a Social Security number, you have no taxable income subject to the income tax. The creditor, again, will find himself wailing and gnashing his teeth. There's nothing for them to legally grab when you volunteer back out.
Okay. Now, we've got, right now, 46 million people are thumbing their nose at the IRS. So we're on our way there.
That is correct.
This is doable. But people have to understand, everybody needs to recognize that this is not an easy row to hoe, but we've got to do it. We don't have any other choice. You can continue to be a slave, deal with what you think is money, or you can take responsibility for yourself get out of their system, do it the right way, in a step-by-step process, so you don't get yourself in a bind with them, and get it done. We're almost there. Well, we have 180 million adults in this country. 46 million is a real good start.
That's right. And if we can get just that 1% over a half, that 51%, to leave the system, we win. No bullets have to fly. No ballot boxes have to be stuffed.
Well, hopefully we can get that done before. Because we are making such headway into that, we do appear to be heading to some serious financial situations in the meantime, and it all may be a very moot point. People may find it very difficult to get out of the system shortly if when the system implodes upon itself as it appears to be manipulated to occur.
Right. They want to get as much people into debt, and this easy credit is a balloon that they're inflating, and once it breaks, they'll be able to legitimately take property in such a manner that the poor victim will think, well, it's my own fault, I lost my job, I couldn't make the payments, et cetera, et cetera. And remember, folks, if you've got a mortgage, you're going to pay at least 3 times the value of the house back in interest charges, so they're not doing you a favor, they're robbing you blind.
Mm-hmm.
You volunteer.
Exactly. Now, as for people that are locked in a mortgage and stuff like that, they don't really have much of an option, do they?
That is true. If I was making, say, $50,000 to $100,000 a year, and I was mortgaged, say, $500,000 in value, it might be cheaper just to walk away from it. Say, here, bank, here, take the house. I don't want it. Here, have the car. Walk away and turn around and rebuild your life. Because if you look at the facts, typical, say, for instance, house construction, you can buy the materials to build a house for about $9,000 to $15,000 Federal Reserve notes. Now, if I go down to a lumber yard and say, I'd like to get a bid on a house, and I want to pay on the bill of sale 21 in silver and the balance in Federal Reserve notes, I guarantee you that lumberyard will say, fine. Now I'll go out there, I'll buy my land for 21 in silver, I'll buy my materials for 21 in silver, and go build a house. Guess what? It's untaxable. It's also immune from judicial process, especially in Georgia. So Georgia gives a $1,600 exclusion, a protection from all judicial process. I don't need a trust to protect myself from getting sued, as long as my value in real money never exceeds $1,600.
In real money.
Yep, that's gold and silver coin.
And if we look at the current, the current gold American Eagle, they have a value on them of 50. They're a 1 ounce gold coin. Are those qualify as lawful money?
I sincerely doubt it, because the federal government tracks those. When you sell those, you have to get the social security number of the buyer. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
But if you sell the $20 coins, it doesn't matter.
The pre-33.
Right, because they're lawful money, and the government cannot regulate those.
And they're lawful money at face value.
Exactly.
So even though you may pay 645 Federal Reserve notes for a $20 St. Gaudens, its legal tender value, its lawful money value, is 20.
That's correct.
And if people have a hard time accepting that discrepancy, can you explain it a little bit so they can grasp it?
In the original Coinage Act of 1792, the federal government pegged gold to silver. The truth of the matter is we never had a gold standard, because a standard is something that doesn't change. And from 1792 to this very day, $1 is still a 1 ounce silver coin. But dollars, when a 1 ounce coin under the 1792 Act was pegged to 20 silver dollars, so that 1 ounce gold coin was stamped $20. It wasn't until after 1933 that Roosevelt jacked it up to $32 an ounce, and then late, of course, confiscated all the gold, so you really had no $32 gold coin circulating. But afterwards, they did issue the 50s. So what you see is the government reneging on its promises to pay gold and playing counterfeiting games. Like if you had a ruler that 1 year says 1 foot and the next year it says 2 feet. Well, you did not get an extra foot of length. You just changed the standard. And that's an unequal weight and measure, which is forbidden in the Bible as well in the law.
But they get away with it because we're not dealing with real money.
And
we're not dealing with a system that is under the Constitution. We're dealing with something that's outside of it that has fallen under Uniform Commercial Code.
It's the emergency due to the bankruptcy.
And is there a viable way to get out of the bankruptcy from a government standpoint?
The government itself is helpless, but the once 51% of the people leave, we people can turn around and say to our servant government, no, 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 we'll take care of you. I'd like to see millions of people march in Washington, D.C. with guns, not to shoot government, but to say to them, we're here to protect you from the creditors. Tell us where to point.
And who is the... A lot of people out there are familiar with the potential army of the creditor, the U.N.
Yes,
so there are several possibilities here, but the bottom line, people, is getting free, is getting out, getting into real money. Now, again, we recognize and we realize that it's not possible to take everything you have, and you shouldn't take everything you have, but it should be a step-by-step process to get out of there. But in the meantime, recognize that with fractional reserve banking, which is what we have today, for every dollar you take out, every Federal Reserve note that you take out of the system, you've denied them nine. And then that would help this entire process along, getting it to a point where we can make the difference.
Just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the fraud, we all hear that the national debt is about $5 trillion and that the private debt is about $17 trillion. But the total amount of Federal Reserve notes in circulation is only a few billion.
And how did it, you know, so again, the fractional reserve banking creates the situation. So for those of you that think, well, it's only $1,000, you know, it doesn't matter. Yes, it does. You've denied them 10. And that starts adding up very quickly. And it also, it helps get us back our government, it helps get us back our country, and everything that we can all do will be very beneficial for everyone involved. Like I said, 46 million people are out of the system. If you're inclined to do it, if you're in a position to do it, I encourage you to give Jeff a call. Unlike Patriots for Profit, Jeff is there because he believes, because he wants this country back without violence. And I think he's on the right track with it.
I do not charge for any help I give. If you're interested in giving donations, that's fine, but I don't ask for them. I've been doing this for about 2 years full-time, no charge.
And unlike others, you know, your books are very reasonable. They're very easy to understand. And Jeff is there to help you people out. Is there anything else, Jeff, that we haven't covered in these last few minutes that you might want to interject?
Well, for you people out there that like to do research, you might want to research into this interesting fact. Can you get a Social Security number without a birth certificate? I've asked around, and people who've applied for it, generally they either have a birth certificate or proof that a birth certificate exists before Social Security would give them the number. And it begs the question, if you were born in America without a birth certificate, can you get a Social Security number? And if that's true, maybe what we need to investigate is the trust nature of the birth certificate. Did we get enrolled into a trust at birth, and that when we signed up for Social Security, we changed the beneficiary of our trust? Something to think about.
Yeah, and it wasn't all that long ago that birth certificates weren't in existence.
That's right.
Your name was placed in the family Bible, and that's where everything was tracked.
That's right. The government didn't give a hoot. If you're an American, you're an American. They had no business looking into your life.
But now, the corporate nature of the situation, the birth certificate we do know is, in essence, a declaration of incorporation, is it not?
Well, what I'm trying to find is something, the smoking gun that says explicitly, and if I can't find the smoking gun, I want to find as much circumstantial evidence that supports that claim. So far, all I can find that's really hard and fast is that Social Security, at this point, will not let you get the number unless you have naturalization papers or a birth certificate. Something that establishes that you're
a U.S. citizen.
Or a trust entity. Because if you're a real human being, it would be an unconscionable contract. See, the trust is the mechanism that they use to get around it in both directions. They can beat the system, and they can beat the limitations of the Constitution. For states are forbidden to impair the obligations of contracts. And a trust is a contract.
Okay, it's, you know, again, get the books. It's easily understood. It's all laid out for you. Again, they're the best books I've ever encountered on it. For those people that have been following Bill's programs for a long time and are familiar with the Mystery of Babylon series and the rest of it, and can't get out of the system. Maybe they're heavily involved in business, and you know, they got so many things out there that it's not a viable option. Point of interest, do know for a fact that the Kraft banks at Bank of America. So you do what you think you need to do, but we do know that that's where they place their money. And I think that should be indicative of what to expect here in the very short term and in the long term. Well, Jeff, I thank you for coming on board this evening. We'll see about maybe continuing this tomorrow. We'll see how Bill's feeling, line something up, go into a little bit more detail. But in the meantime, I want to go ahead and do a little bit of metals report.
Right. And anyone wants to call me, I'll be on my phone available for another hour or so, and then I'll just let the machine take it.
All right then, Jeff. Thanks very much, and we'll be discussing. We'll give you a holler tomorrow.
Okay.
All right, people. Last week, we saw some very strange things happening in the market. On Monday, the Dow opened an hour late. And when it did open, it was off 101 points. Now, this makes us wonder, what's going on? What actually can happen? How far down can it go? So we made some inquiries. Stock market curves. When the Dow has a 50-point drop, computer trading is suspended. What that is automatic, well, if this stock goes below this point, sell it. Put out a sell order. That is trading that's suspended. Floor trading, phone trading, broker trading, that's all continuing. So we can still see continuing declines. That will not change at a 50-point drop until things either level off or start going the other direction. If the Dow drops 250 points, trading, all trading, is suspended for 1 hour. If it drops 400 points in 1 day, trading, all trading, is halted for 2 hours. Now, if things come back to any degree, and if it closes within 25 points of the previous day's trading, then all the stops are rescinded. But the reality is, I believe we have a 7-hour trading day, and with, I had it figured out, I think it can drop like 800 points in a day. That's an awful lot of points, and like we discussed with Bill a couple weeks ago, each point on the Dow pretty much represents $1 trillion in liquidity on a general level. So it won't take a whole long time, and in a descending stock market, how quick do you think you can get your funds out? Money markets take 2 weeks to clear. Something to think about, people. Like we told you, we expect to see legislation that gives us a capital gains tax cut next year. Do what you got to do. Being on board this evening, look forward to talking to you. We'll probably be talking to you tomorrow night. Bill will probably be out for the rest of the week. Promise to have a reading show. All very up to date and informed. Y'all have a good evening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.